welcome to the Pirate Monk Podcast, episode 52. Mondo and I are here today by ourselves. Nate is is sunbathing in Florida at the moment.
Yeah, I think you're probably Studio B and I'm C today, because what we got going on, Nate is definitely Studio A.
And it's possible that he's wearing less clothes than me right now, laying out.
That's highly possible.
So we've got good stuff. In fact, today is a special episode because we are going to be playing I'll call it a talk.
A talk.
It's not a sermon.
You're right, it's a talk.
But if you played it on Sunday morning, it would be a sermon. But
right.
Since, you know, right now it's Monday.
It's Monday.
Guys won't get this till Tuesday or later. It's just a talk.
That's absolutely.
But he was at Christ Community Church speaking to young men and their fathers, and I got a chance to listen to it, and I'm excited for guys to get to hear this.
Oh, yeah.
Super, super relevant. Like we were talking about before, of all the Samson meetings I've gone to, the average age seems to be somewhere in the 40s.
Yeah.
And that bums me out a little bit because I see how much it's a reaction to lives lived in isolation.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're coming out of isolation, and what an amazing gift to give to young men,
right,
to invite them into the company of older guys so that they start to learn some skills that were lacking,
right,
and cause so many problems in older men's lives. So we're going to get to that coming up, but what's been going on in the Mondo Grimes household?
Man, we have been busy, bruh. It's been 3 weeks have been just crazy. I don't know if you know, but I think I told you, we had a death in the family. So we had some bereavement to take care of in New Jersey and Miami. So it's kind of a long story, something very tragic. It was a murder in the family, and so we had to take care of all that business. And
this was on your wife's side?
Yeah. And so it's... getting through that was challenging, and there's a lot of healing still to take place.
How is she doing?
She's doing good, man. She's a strong woman. She's doing pretty good. This is a relative that's very close to her. She's very strong. Of course, you know, she's had her moments, her private moments, and I've been there. And of course, as a man, it's probably one of the weakest moments you will ever feel as a husband, you know, because you realize there's nothing you can do to fix it.
So it's
tough for me in a different way. And of course, I knew her aunt as well, very well. So it was, she's doing good. She's a lot better. We're just trying to be there for some of the other family members, my wife's father, and you know, other aunts and uncles and stuff like that. So we're getting through it. You know, everything's good. We were, you know, taking care of that for a while, and had to take a little break just to kind of get away for a little bit. Did a little traveling just to kind of, you know, unplug, and also had to go out of town for work as well. So it's been the last 3 weeks have been really busy, man. So
crazy traveling for all you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah, exactly. Between, you know, of course, unexpected bereavement and work, and you know, just it got to a point where it was like, okay, you know what, we just got to leave. It's getting out of control. You know, it's just, you need to unplug sometimes, man. And it was good for us to do that. So how about you, man? What you been up to?
I had a great 3 days in San Francisco with my second son. You know, I've got three sons and a daughter, and I try to take them on alone adventures. And I am a low respecter of school attendance. Mm. You know, if they were teaching something I thought was earth-shattering, then maybe I would feel different, but I spent most of my high school career trying to figure out how to be in Taco Bell.
Yeah.
You know, small town. There weren't a lot of options. We didn't have a miniature golf course or anything, so
like
it was Taco Bell. So, grabbed my 8-year-old out of school, and we hit the road. Went to San Francisco, got a municipal bus pass so that we could ride all the trolleys and cable cars and buses, and we just went everywhere for 3 days. Walked 15 miles,
wow,
hung out in Alcatraz, the Exploratorium, Chinatown, and just had an amazing time. He did not want to come home. That's always a good sign.
That is incredible. That is awesome, man. That's incredible.
And San Francisco is such a fun town to hang out in.
It's such a
tight city. And just the community that you feel there. And middle of the week in winter, Man, we had like 75 degree weather every day.
Ugh.
Perfectly clear skies, no fog, and no tourists.
Oh,
when
yeah.
we were walking around ships and stuff, we were the only people on some of those.
Oh, wow. That's cool, man. That is very cool.
So
that's awesome.
It was a fantastic 3 days, yep. and now enjoying being back home. My wife's birthday was Saturday. Today's
okay.
Valentine's. Do you have some Valentine's Day romantic plans in store? What are you doing?
Well, actually, switching it up a bit. I took out this morning. Took my girls out, my babies out to Valentine's Day breakfast. So we had a little breakfast time this morning and hung out and actually my mother's in town as well, and so hung out with the ladies this morning. Took them out to Valentine's breakfast. My wife is still out of town, so she'll be back on Thursday. So and her birthday's on Friday. So Valentine's Day is not really a big day in my house with my wife. It's more about, you know, everyone else. But the birthday is actually birth week and not birthday. I don't know if you're familiar with birth week.
Yeah. I've got one of those wives as well.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, well, tell me real quick, because, like, I don't care about birthdays. I always feel like people should send my mom a card.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, this was much more about her labor, not mine.
Exactly.
So I'm not a huge birthday person, but my wife is.
Yeah,
so I have
yeah.
to make some pretty major adjustments. And I have your same pain where, you know, 2 days before Valentine's is birthday, which is supposed to be super special.
Yeah.
And my wife doesn't like us spending a lot of money.
Yeah.
So it's hard to do super special
with minimal money
on two occasions within 2 days with minimal money. It's like, you know what? I'm totally lost. All right, here's another picnic. That's you know.
I know. Right?
That's all
yeah.
I got.
I know. I'm right there with you, man. So I'm actually in the planning process right now, trying to figure out what to do when she gets back. She gets back on the 17th. Her birthday's on the 18th. So. Yeah, I'm in planning mode right now, kind of crunch time. It's like, you know, got a couple, it's like 2 minute drill in the fourth quarter, bro. I'm struggling.
Well, there you go. So there is time for guys to email at the samsonpodcast@gmail.com to give Mondo ideas
oh, yeah.
on how to romance his bride on her birthday.
Yeah, and a birth week as well.
right, sorry, birthday week.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
So.
I need some ideas, guys.
So that's
help me out.
So that's starting really at her birthday and a week after, since she's getting back. That doesn't seem fair. Leading up, okay.
I know.
Kind of like doing Christmas for the week after Christmas. That, you know, you can lead up to it, but you can't. You got to take the tree down.
Yeah. I lost that negotiation.
Yeah. I was gonna say, you can tell your wife that I said sorry. The tree's got to come down after the birthday,
that,
and
then
just
what
see
I'm
how
saying.
That goes. You can feel it out. I can be the bad guy.
Exactly.
It works.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Exactly, man. Well, it sounds pretty cool.
All right.
It sounds good that you had a great time with your son, because it has it kind of streamlines right into what Nate is talking about in his talk to Christ Community Church that we're going to play today. Tell us a little bit about what Nate's talking about.
Yeah, I really enjoyed listening to it. He's speaking. You know, John gives these three designations when he's at the end of his life, speaking to children, speaking to fathers, and speaking to young men. And in our society, we've added this adolescent period, which I was so glad Nate talked about, because it's one of my biggest pet peeves that we tell, you know, throughout history. When you hit puberty, you go out, you're working with your dad, you know, you're at home with mom until the time that you can go out with your dad to learn your trade, and then you learn to be a man by walking with your dad in real life. And then we added this thing at the point that throughout history and almost every culture, you would actually be stepping into manhood, and we created adolescence, which keeps getting extended farther and farther. It's ridiculous. You know, I hear a lot of psychologists saying that you shouldn't get married before you're 28 because you don't really know who you are, and so if you get married before that, you know, what's going to become of your marriage, all of that. So now adolescence is kind of extended into your late 20s, mm-hmm. and there's no point at which a young man is told that he's a man.
Right.
So here you are with all of these pubescent emotions and hormones with nothing to do with them. You just go to high school and act like a fool. Then you go to college and act like an arrogant fool.
Yeah.
And so Nate's really speaking to that. Okay. And I think this is going to be great for guys that either have children or even if they don't, I think men in the church need to step up and start bringing along younger men into their lives. Yeah. One of my favorite periods of ministry was a time when I would pick up a homeschool guy once a week on Tuesdays, and I would just bring him to work, and he would do work with me every Tuesday.
Yeah.
And I think we don't realize, obviously I have a job where I could do that, but I think we don't actually look at our lives and realize how many spots we can bring in mm-hmm. a young man and show him what it is to be a man.
Yeah.
And it's a lot easier. I've said many times I'm a much better person because I'm a pastor, so it's my, you know, I can't get away with as many things as maybe I would have if I wasn't a pastor.
Yeah.
But it's the same for any man. You bring along a young man and you'll start acting more like a man because you're doing it in the presence of someone that needs to learn.
Oh yeah. I agree
with
that. So yeah.
That's what Nate's going to be talking about, and we hope you enjoy it.
All right, let's check out Nate, and we'll come back after his talk with some Samson Society house business.
Well, I can't tell you how good it feels to be in a room this size, full of guys. Because this is what church is supposed to be like. Very, very, very rarely is church like this. Doesn't this kind of almost feel strange? How often do we get this many guys together in one room at church? Doesn't happen much. I'm Nate Larkin. How many of you guys have not read Samson and the Pirate Monks or heard me speak before? Can I see hands? Okay, we got a few. Most of you know my story, and so I'm not going to belabor it. But for those of you who don't know my story, haven't read the book, I'm a recovering sex addict. I was absolutely convinced that if that ever got out, if people ever knew that I struggled with lust as badly as I struggle, that my ministry would be over. And I was destined from the time I was a child to be in the ministry. My dad was a preacher. I grew up in church. I was good at church. Everybody knew I was going to be a preacher. That was my identity. Now, little did I know that really my ministry would not start until I got honest with myself and then shared my life with other people. So, for me, sex addiction can take all kinds of forms. We human beings are remarkable creatures, and we have the capacity to sexualize almost anything. So sexual addictions come in all kinds of flavors, all kinds of struggles. Mine began with pornography as a softcore pornography as a kid, as a teenager. Every guy sees porn. I didn't know that. Every guy likes porn. I didn't know that either. Because porn depicts something that we're wired by God to want. I just had this sense from the moment I saw it the first time that there was something wrong with this. This was bad. I felt guilty for having seen it and ashamed of having liked it. So I did what guilt does. I lied, and I did what shame does. I hid. And then to protect my reputation as Saint Nate, the golden boy of the church, the guy who was destined for the top in the ecclesiastical world, I performed up a storm. And I kept my lust life very, very carefully hidden. I was never caught. For me, the pornography problem metastasized after marriage. I thought that marriage was going to cure my porn problem. I really did. I regarded porn really as practice for marriage. What I didn't understand is that I was poisoning my marriage with my regular use of pornography. Because porn offers this artificial connection with an imaginary person, which, if you take it, begins to dull your capacity to create and sustain a real relationship with an actual person. Long-term use of porn creates a serious intimacy disorder. I didn't know that. Small wonder that I wasn't able to connect on an emotional level with my wife. Small wonder that the sexual fantasies that had been painted for me by the pornographers did not come true with my actual wife. Somehow, reality could never match fantasy. And so my lust actually metastasized after I got married. And in seminary, it got much worse. It was in seminary, on a seminary-sponsored trip to New York City, that I got my first look at hardcore pornography. This was in the 70s. Actually, with my wife beside me in the peep show booth in Times Square, she put the quarter in. And our reactions to that explicit depiction of sex were different. I mean, she was sickened by what she saw. I had a brief moment of clarity in which I was sickened too, because I could tell that this was exploitation. It was a performance. It was a way to get money out of me that was going to go to organized crime. That this was not real intimacy. But at the same time, it stimulated something very deep within me. It fed a hunger, a very, very deep hunger in me. And you'd have to know my whole story to know kind of the depth and the genesis of that hunger. I was more susceptible to this than even the average guy. And so it wasn't too many days after that that I found myself slipping away from wife and family and seminary, driving the family station wagon down to Trenton, New Jersey, to look for a new source for my drug. Because make no mistake about it, lust is a powerful, powerful drug. Stimulates the same pleasure centers in the brain that cocaine does. Triggers that same chemical cascade, that temporary sense of well-being. Just an illusion, just a moment, a sense of connection. That always dissipates and leaves you hungrier and lonelier and needing it more. So that was a long fight for me. I did wind up in the ministry. It was in the ministry that I picked up my first hooker. On a Christmas Eve, on my way to lead a candlelight service. Picked up, you know, blustery night, cold night, shivering girl on the sidewalk. I did the chivalrous thing and picked her up, not knowing what she was doing. She propositioned me when she got in the car. She wanted $20. I happened to have $20. And that $20 didn't go on the offering plate. And I never thought I would do that. Porn took me places I never expected to go. I thought I was incapable of that. But I wasn't. And the worst part of that night, as I often say, is the knowledge, the sure and certain knowledge that I had that I was going to do it again. I only lasted a few more years in the ministry. I did pick up more and more hookers in Fort Lauderdale. I was living in Fort Lauderdale at the time. So cruising the strip and picking up mostly teenage hookers. That's what was there. Um, I didn't see him as people. I didn't see him as somebody's daughter, somebody's sister, somebody's girlfriend, somebody's mom. I never stopped to think about what drove them to do what they were doing. It was, in the words of the New Testament, I was walking by the flesh and not by the Spirit. Sexual acting out of that type is very much disassociative behavior. You really have to go away from your real self to do it. And I learned to toggle. It's amazing. It was truly a Jekyll and Hyde experience. I would snap. I'm Nate. I'm Pastor Nate. I'm Saint Nate. I'm the Nate everybody knows, everybody loves, everybody trusts. And the next minute, boom, I'm cruising. And hiding. And feeling awful about what I was doing. My own hypocrisy sickened me. And I screamed at God to heal me, to take it away. I don't want this compulsion. I begged him time and time again for a private solution to my private problem. The one thing I could never even conceive of doing was telling anybody. I knew, first of all, it wouldn't have been safe to tell anybody in church. I saw what happened to guys who were found out, or guys foolish enough to take our rhetoric about grace at face value and in some desperate moment say what they were really doing. And I participated. That's the strange thing. I participated in running some of those guys out of the ministry and out of the church. Me. But I eventually quit the ministry because I was terrified of getting caught and losing my reputation. At the age of 30, I quit. Went into business where I had the misfortune to make a lot of money. Not something you ought to have if you're an active addict of any kind. I had even less accountability in business than I'd had in the ministry. A lot more money. And so I didn't have to pick up girls on the street anymore. I became more circumspect. And then, of course, when the internet came along, that supercharged the whole deal. I didn't have to go looking for porn anymore, because now porn came looking for me. Every bit as explicit as the stuff that I used to see in those sleazy, dark adult bookstores and the clattering peep show projection booths. Now I could get in the privacy of my own home anonymously and without any, even without even paying any money. I didn't actually do it at home. I did it at the office. I had to work at the office late every night. But anyway, that consumed more than a decade of my life. It's a lost decade. It's the decade during which my children were growing up. I wasn't there. I spent most of my time in a disassociated state, driven by a sexual compulsion that I could not control. And the only time it felt like I got a little peace was when I would come to church, and I came to church every Sunday. I was active in church. I taught Sunday school. I sang in the worship team. I even preached on occasion. And it was there that I would assume this persona that I thought was the one that God wanted me to be. I could be Mr. Christian. I could be Saint Nate. I could sing those songs with feeling. I could breathe. It's just that I could never get that guy to breathe on his own for very long outside the building. Because he wasn't real. He wasn't real. And he wasn't the Nate that God loves. I kept sending, God called me, I would send this religious persona, which I thought was the one he wanted to, that was the me he wanted. He made me. He loves me. He died for me. All he wanted to see was me. I was afraid to come. Well, my world changed a little over 12 years ago when my wife and I moved from South Florida here to Middle Tennessee. We started attending Christ Community Church, began to hear the gospel of grace preached with a clarity that I had never heard it preached before. And it was at that time that my wife, for the first time, caught me. I'd never been caught before. So she caught me on the internet late at night. We got through that crisis, and then she found a condom on the floor in the bathroom that I couldn't quite explain, and that's when she said, "I'm done." She said, "I still love you, but I don't like you. I don't trust you. I don't respect you. I don't think you can ever change. I'm done." The only woman I'd ever really loved, and I certainly hadn't loved her well, but she was all I had. I knew I had one shot, maybe, one chance to save the marriage, and that was to get some help. And incidentally, 4 out of 5 guys who seek help for sexually compulsive behavior do so only after receiving an ultimatum from a wife or a girlfriend. My wife did me the greatest favor when she drew a line in the sand. I owe her my life. I wound up in a group, a 12-step group, and I won't belabor the point. The story is in Samson and the Pirate Monks. But that's where I first encountered a truly safe room where you could... Where personas were not welcome. If you brought a false self, people really didn't trust you. But as long as you brought your real self and said the real truth, it didn't matter how bad that truth was. It didn't matter at all. They just wanted to hear it. They wanted to see you. And they had this conviction, even there, in a group that didn't seem to know God's proper name, they had this conviction that God loves us. God knows us. We can only follow Him together. And that when we meet, He's here and He does stuff. He makes miracles happen. He brings healing. It lines up pretty well, by the way, with the New Testament prescription for healing. Confess your sins to one another and pray for one another that you may be healed, it says in the book of James. And I'd been kept from that healing because the church had never been a safe place for me to confess. Now, I will tell you this. I was scared stiff on my first meetings. 12-step meetings. My biggest fear at the first meeting was I was afraid I was going to meet a gay guy. I was terrified. I was going to meet a guy in there who was gay. And I don't know what that scared me about that. I thought maybe I would catch it. Now, I was convinced that because all my sexual sin was heterosexual sin, that I was secure in my masculinity. The fact that I was scared to be around a gay guy should have been a hint that I was not as secure in my masculinity as I thought I was. And I eventually got a sponsor in that 12-step group, a guy who began to walk me through this marvelous redemptive path of, confession and restitution and surrender. What a marvelous adventure. And it wasn't too far down that path that I began to see that I was not secure in my masculinity at all. That was one of the reasons why porn had such an appeal for me. Because imaginary women were not as dangerous as real women. I could pretend. It was one of the reasons that I liked hookers. Because as long as you had money, they never said no. No risk of rejection if you got the dollars. And my very delicate male ego couldn't stand rejection. Now, I met other guys in the 12-step group for sex addicts who had never paid for sex and who really could take or leave porn. Those were the guys who were the chronic womanizers, the guys who had been engaged in seduction and conquest for years, the guys who were in triple digits with the women they'd slept with. And at first, I thought that those guys were more secure in their masculinity than I was. After a while, I came to understand, as they did as well, that they were as afraid as I was. They were driven in their pursuit of women because they had to prove something that they didn't know. And somehow, by conquest, maybe they could extract from her the verdict that they were a man. Maybe this one would prove to their own heart that they were really masculine. But no woman could do it. They could never answer the question. They had to go chase another one. So here I am. I'm sitting around with a bunch of guys and we're all messed up sexually. And at the core of our problems is a deep uncertainty about our masculinity. And that in itself was a very, very difficult admission for me to make. Now, there's one thing my dad taught me was don't ever let them doubt your masculinity. I mean, the least masculine thing you can do is let somebody doubt your masculinity. My dad, you know, for a long time, I saw my dad as kind of the standard for masculinity. I thought he was the real man. Because my dad was a man's man. He was cocky. He was confident. At least that's what he projected. It took years before I saw that beneath that cockiness and that confrontational attitude that he took, Dad would always say, you got to make him respect you. You go into a room, if you think a guy's going to hit you, you hit him first. I never hit a guy once. But Dad would say, you hit him first. Right? Dad always had problems with authority, so he never was able to stay within a denomination or a corporation. And after I left home, literally dozens of young men came to my dad and pled with him to disciple them in the Christian life and in ministry. Because they saw him as I saw him, as a real man. But he didn't know how to relate to the younger guys. All he knew how to do was insult them and put them down, and push them, and eventually they all drifted away. My dad went from having the biggest church in town to the smallest church in town. And he died alone. I was in Catalina with my wife last week. And late one night, I couldn't sleep. Thank God I didn't go look at porn or anything. Instead, I turned on a nature show on television. This one happened to be about giraffes, but all these nature shows are pretty much the same, you know? And they describe the male of the species and the female of the species and then what they do, right? So this one happened to be giraffes. And giraffes, you know, the male, 19 feet tall. Female, yeah, about 15, 16 feet tall. Male, weighs 2 tons. Female, weighs about a ton. Here's a hint. If you see giraffes from a distance, you know, a couple miles away, and you want to tell, I'm going to go on a safari in Tanzania in a couple of months with my uncle, so I'm going to use this little hint. I now know how to tell male giraffes from female giraffes at a distance. Want to know the secret? Male giraffes eat from the tops of the trees. Female giraffes bend their necks and eat lower. So, from a distance, you can tell. Male giraffes also tend to wander off into thick brush, and females won't. Females hang out together in groups, and they kind of nurse the kids together, have a little nursery they run. The male giraffes, they tend to have these bachelor herds that they kind of run in. The older ones tend to stay by themselves. Now, you could run that same thing with... you've seen the nature shows, you know. So, the female coyote, the male coyote. The Bible makes it plain that God created all these living things, and He created them to reproduce after their kind. And it doesn't matter what it is, what species it is. You know, a scientist familiar with the species can tell you what is the female and what is the male, and what the male looks like and what the male tends to do, what the female looks like, what the female tends to do. It's scripted. The Bible says in Genesis 1:27 that God created man in His image. Male and female created He them. All right there. So He created us. We, both us and the women, bear His image. I don't know. I think maybe His attributes are apportioned to us in different measure. We're distinctly different. And we're physically different. We're bigger than they are. Our brains, by the way, 11% to 12% bigger than their brains. The brains are wired different from their brains. We think differently than they do. And that works its way out between the mental wiring and the hormonal differences. It's interesting. Baby girls like toys with faces. Baby boys like things they can manipulate. My daughter just had twins a little over a year ago. Wyatt and Ruby, girl and a boy. You know, at 8 months old, Wyatt took apart the remote control. They stayed at our house last night. And the twins were in my office, side by side in little pack and plays. I went in this morning, and they're both sitting up in bed. And Ruby looks at me and lifts up a doll and goes, "Baby!" And Wyatt picks up, looks at me, lifts up a matchbox car and says, "Vroom!" Nobody taught him that. But here's the difference between us and most of the animal kingdom. For most of the animal kingdom, male behavior, masculine behavior, is purely instinctual. There's some coaching that goes on, some training, but typically very little. With us, it's not the same. There certainly are male characteristics and male behaviors that are instinctual. I think, you know, farting and laughing about it are pretty much instinctual. But most of what it means to be a man comes to us by way of socialization. We have to be taught. And that knowledge is transferred from man to man. You know, the Bible doesn't tell us a whole lot about Jesus' early life. It tells us really almost nothing about His childhood except, you know, a nighttime trip to Egypt and some time down there. And then we see at 12 years old, his parents take him to the temple. This is a key turning point in Jesus' life. It was at this same age, at 12 or 13, right around puberty or after puberty, that every Jewish boy made his trip to the temple. Up until that time, he'd been primarily under the care of his mother and trained in the synagogue where he'd been taught the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. Probably by the age of 12, 13, Jesus knew the first five books of the Bible by heart. You know, you couldn't give your kid a Bible. There was only one Bible in each town. It was in a big scroll. You know, you had to go check it. So the best way to make sure that everybody knew the Bible was you just memorized the thing. But at age 12 or 13 now, you would go to the temple there to be examined by the elders. And that marked your exit from childhood and your entrance into adulthood, young adulthood. And then it says that Jesus continued to grow in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. He already has his messianic consciousness at age 12, 13. Didn't you know, he says to his parents, that I must be about my father's business? He already knows who his father is. But it's strangely silent about Jesus' life until the age of 30, when he suddenly appears at the Jordan River to be baptized. The Holy Spirit descends on him in the form of a dove, and from heaven this voice that says, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased." Jesus goes into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil, the only guy, by the way, to have faced the devil alone for any extended length of time and defeated him. And upon his return from the desert, he begins to call disciples. Now, what typically happened in those days for a Jewish boy was, at the age of 13, you went to the temple. It's possible that you might become a rabbi if your answers to the questions were exceptional. You could apply to a rabbi and ask the rabbi to allow you to follow him. And if he agreed, then you would become the rabbi's disciple. You would learn to take his body of teaching, known as his yoke. And you'd get it by osmosis. What you would do is you would follow him around for years. Most guys did not become rabbis. Most guys went back home to begin to learn a trade. They would become apprentices. If not to their father, then typically to another relative. They begin to learn a trade, begin to earn their living. 12, 13, 14 years old now, they're earning a wage. They're learning a skill. Now, I speak at youth camps from time to time. And there's something I like to do in youth camp. I'll be in a room, you know, full of kids, and I'll say, okay, we're going to get started. Are there any adults here? And, you know, a couple of counselors raise their hands, you know. Say, okay, all right, well, we're going to be discussing some stuff here that's kind of sensitive. Are there any children in the room? Usually one or two counselors will raise their hand, get a little laugh. And then I'll say, I noticed that most of you did not raise your hand either time. I ask if you were an adult, and you weren't. And I ask if you were a child, and you weren't that either. So I'm wondering, what are you? What do we call them? What do we call this person between puberty and adulthood, whenever that is? We call them an adolescent. Yeah. Yeah, what does the Bible say about adolescents? Nothing. Nothing. The word was not even invented until the 1890s. This is a brand new category. Juvenile. You know, in biology, you're one of two things. You're prepubescent or you're pubescent. Yeah, there are some juvenile characteristics and you can be postmenopausal, but you're still an adult. And that's always how it's been. You're a child, and then you become an adult. Paul says, when I was a child, I spoke as a child, I thought as a child, I understood as a child, but when I became a man, I put away childish things. There was no extended transitional phase called adolescence. I happen to think that adolescence was created mostly for economic reasons. It was a way to kind of keep young men out of the workforce for a while. Here's the amazing thing about young men. Men between the ages of 15 and 25 have 50% more synapses in their brain than somebody over 30. They are... That is that peak time in a man's life for creativity. Is it weird that the two hottest corporations in the country right now, Google and Facebook, both founded by people we have been trained to regard as pre-adults? No, it's not surprising. It's the same thing that Steve Jobs and Bill Gates did, generation before. Where does the innovation come in music and in art? It comes during those key years of young adulthood. let me point this out for you. In the book of 1 John, I thought I had my Bible here. I don't know what I did with it. Is there a Bible? 1 John chapter 2. Let me just read this real quick. And I'm going to get to the point. 1 John. Thank you. Thank you, John. Okay. By the way, the book of 1 John was written by the Apostle John, who was the last apostle to die. As far as we know, he may have lived into the, past the end of the first century. He's the old John the Revelator. He's the guy who wrote Revelation. One of the reasons for his longevity is that he was also the youngest disciple. Extra biblical sources indicate that he may have been as young as 14 when Jesus called him. All of Jesus' disciples, by the way, were young men. He changed the world with young men. But it appears that John may have been the youngest, about 14, 15 years old when Jesus called him. Now he's an old man. And he's writing to the church. And he addresses the whole church here in 1 John. But he breaks the church into segments, three segments. 1 John chapter 2. I'm going to start in verse 9 because I think it's key to the whole point, to the whole concept that I want to convey to you tonight. Anyone who says, I am in the light, but hates his brother or sister. Actually, it only says brother. I don't know what it is. It's the Max Lucado Bible. The Greek says brother, but point well taken. Okay, but anyone who says I am in the light but hates his brother is still in the darkness. Whoever loves his brother is in the light and will not cause anyone to stumble in his faith. But whoever hates a brother is in darkness, lives in darkness, and doesn't know where to go because the darkness has made him blind. Now he addresses the whole church. John says, starts in verse 12, I write to you, dear children, because your sins are forgiven through Christ. I write to you, fathers, this is rendered parents in this translation. I write to you, fathers, because you know the one who existed from the beginning. I write to you, young men, because you have defeated the evil one. Children, fathers, young men. And then he repeats it. I write to you, children, because you know the Father. I write to you, fathers, because you know the one who existed from the beginning. I write to you, young men, because you are strong. And the word of God lives in you, and you have defeated the evil one. Three groups. Children, young men, fathers. These are the stages of the developmental stages of the Christian life, biblically. When you're a child, and here's what changes. When you move from childhood to adulthood. Now, granted, there are kind of two stages of adulthood. There are young men and there are fathers. In Jewish society, you were considered a father when your kids were having kids. Or when you were taking disciples, when you were leading disciples or apprentices. You move kind of that sage role. But you are a young man from the time you were about 13. You left childhood, you became a young man, and now you're going to learn how to be a man in this world. And how are you going to learn it? Who are you going to learn it from? You're going to learn it from men. You move into the circle of men. Church looks a lot like this, except that there's a lot more young men than we have in this room right now. And it's here that you learn what it means to be a man. You learn that your relationship to women changes. You know, when you were a child, you were protected by your mother. Mothers protect children, right? I mean, if a woman is given the choice between catching a fly ball or saving an infant child, she will save the infant child without even stopping to consider whether there's a man on base. I killed the line, but anyway. You don't want to get between a she-bear and a cub. Mothers protect children. Men protect women. It's different now. It's different. Mothers provide for children. They provide everything. They think about their kids all the time. That amazes me about my wife and my daughter, to watch them as mothers. Because they remember clothes, and they're sensitive to moods, and they know appointments, and they know who the friends are, and they're concerned about... They just know all this stuff. You know, I'm vaguely aware of small people in the building. Okay? But they provide... Women provide for children. Men provide for women. That's what we do. We provide. So that they can do what they do. children use women. I mean, I hate to say it, but it's true. Children are selfish little suckers. Right? They just want to be taken care of. Now, Art had to leave early, at the break, my friend Art DeArmond. Art grew up in the 60s, 50s, 40s, I don't know, I can say 30s, he's not here. He grew up in Alabama. And as a child, he had a black wet nurse, a mammy, who nursed him as a child. Did Art care that it was not his mother? No! It was a nipple, right? It was... He didn't love his mother as much as he loved mothering. He wanted to be taken care of. Children use women. It's okay. They're kids. Men love women. Men don't just see a nipple. They don't just see body parts. They don't objectify the person. They see the person. It's not about them. It's about her. They're willing to lay down their life for her. They love. So everybody's talking these days about this, you know, this scourge in American society. It seems like guys are leaving home later and later. And I talk with these wives, and the guy is just, he's so selfish, and he won't get a job, and these crazy relationships where the girl's supporting the guy, and it's, they're talking about failure to launch, the guy just can't leave home. And then, of course, in church, I'm going to do something here really unpopular. I hate to do it, but I'm going to do it anyway. In church, we accommodate the culture. The culture created this special category for young men. Now here, I got to tell you, young men have always been at the cutting edge of the growth of the church. Always. These are the guys who start missionary movements. Just like in all our wars, we send these guys. We send the 18, 19, 20-year-olds. Those are the guys we send to the front lines. Why? Because they're strong. They're creative. They're innovative. They're at the peak, right? But as far as the culture is concerned, we tell this guy, we tell this kid, we call him a kid. He's 15, 16, 17. We won't give him the dignity of calling him a man. We won't tell him he's a man. We'll say, put it on hold. Go play. We'll make it illegal for him to hold a full-time job. Can't work. Come on. Go play. We'll make school mandatory. That helped. It was a big part of it. We'll create a whole different justice system for him. Until he reaches the age of 18, he can get away with murder. Because, you know, adults make choices, and those choices have consequences, but those rules do not apply if you're not an adult. Then we'll just say you're not an adult. And somehow, magically, you're going to develop a moral sense on your 18th birthday. So we take these young men, and we don't even bring them into church. We get in their own church. In a lot of cases, pretend church, game church. We need them. But we regard them as second-class citizens, or not even citizens at all. Did you know that statistics show that 80% of the kids presently involved in a church youth program will not be going to church 5 years after they graduate from high school? It doesn't work. It isn't biblical. It's crazy. It isn't helping them, and it isn't helping us. Here's the truth. The church needs young men. Needs their energy. Needs their drive. Needs their impertinence and their impolite questions. Needs their mistakes. Matthew Ward's in the house. Matthew remembers the Jesus movement in the 70s. Who led the Jesus movement?
Bunch of kids.
Bunch of freaking kids!
Or young adults.
Yeah. That's right. What they were is they were young men and young women. Now, there is an arrogance that comes with youth. And the truth is, we older men, we fathers, need young men. And young men need us as well. There is a wisdom that comes with maturity, with enough mistakes. There is some stability that we can bring. There's some guidance that we can add. I'm writing a book with Darrell Waltrip right now. I'm learning all about NASCAR. And he drove for a long time for a guy named Junior Johnson, a legendary driver, NASCAR driver in the 50s and 60s, who then became an owner. And Darrell drove for him, and Junior used to say, "I want a driver who's in his late 29s. And Darrell has talked to me about this. He really thinks that the guys with the most natural ability and the guys whose reflexes are the best, guys who have the biggest drives, are those guys in the 20s. But then there's kind of this peak at around 29, 30. They're almost topping 30, and they're getting a little more wisdom to temper it. And in Darrell's view, that's kind of like peak years for a driver. And then after that, eventually a guy's better suited to be an owner or a coach or an analyst than he is to be a driver. He's an older guy. And he's the kind of older guy that the younger guys need. I'm trying to make these changes myself. The other day, a couple of young men in white shirts, black pants, wearing black backpacks talked to me. And one of them introduced himself as Elder Johnson. And you know who they were, right? Okay, they were Mormons. And at first I wanted to laugh. Elder Johnson? What? How old are you? 18? What are you? Elder what? Who told you? And then I thought, somebody told him he's a man. Somebody entrusted the mission of the church to him. Somebody sent him out here to talk to me and told him he can do it. Doing something right. We'd have him running around with a blindfold eating ping pong balls. Okay, why men's ministry in the American church today sucks. Okay? It does. Because we forgot how to get together. It used to be natural. It used to be at puberty, you're now a young man. You come and you sit among the men. You begin to participate. You're even qualified to be a disciple. You're valued. You're important. And you got a lot to learn. And if you'll stick around and you'll bring your real self, you will learn from these men how to be a man. You'll learn who you are. You'll have masculinity fleshed out for you. There's a lot of wailing these days about how men have left the church. And men's ministry doesn't work. The best we can do is an annual pancake breakfast, and then the turnout is awful. It's because we bought into the paradigm. I love what Brandon's vision is for this church and for men's ministry. I love the idea of not segregating the young men anymore. I'm trying to think myself, where can I make room in my ministry and in my business for more apprentices? I need to surround myself with more young men. Not just for their sake, but for my sake. Because here's what I know about young guys. Young guys will notice things I don't even see. They'll spot opportunities I'm totally blind to. They have creative abilities that I once had that I lost along with my evaporating memory. I need young men. And young men need me. If you're a young man in this room tonight, I want to apologize to you and repent for considering you a kid. I've been conditioned in that way, and it's wrong. It's sinful and it's destructive to me and to you and to the church. You're not a kid. You're a man. And I need you. And I want to say this to all of you. Please do not hear any condemnation or criticism from me about your... If you look at yourself as I'm talking, you think, heck, maybe I'm struggling with my masculinity too. Maybe I don't have a handle on it. Please don't hear from me anything that says you screwed up, straighten up. We live in a fallen world. And the way it was supposed to work, it ain't working. You have been affected. We've all been affected by the sin of others. I used to be really, really mad at my dad for not being the dad that I needed him to be. So I became a dad, failed almost as miserably with my own sons. And when I looked at my dad's upbringing and saw that he was raised by an absent alcoholic father, Listen, if you're struggling today with your masculinity, I don't care where the struggle goes. I don't care if you have a struggle with your sexual identity. I do not. By the way, you're a brother, even if you are struggling with that core question. I don't care whether you mask your insecurity with sexual behavior. I don't care whether you mask your insecurity by trying to dominate other men in business or in sports. I don't care whether you try to mask it by engaging in risk-taking behavior with extreme sports or gambling. I don't care whether you just medicate out with alcohol or drugs or video games. What I want you to hear from me is, first of all, the compassion of the Christ. If you're not fully centered in your masculinity today, if God created you not just as a person, but as a male person. Your masculinity is a key part of who He made you to be. If you're not in touch with that yet, it's because you should have been told things that you were never told. You should have been helped in ways that you were never helped. No man can make his own way to masculinity. And no woman can get us there. A man is only a man among men. That's how it's transmitted. So this group of men, we're fractured, we're broken. But the topic of this event tonight is redeeming masculinity. And I want you to know that God is all about redemption. I personally have made more progress in masculinity and becoming comfortable in my own skin as a man. Now, I've got to tell you, I still battle and struggle. I'm not nearly as secure in my masculinity as I hope to be. I don't inhabit fully that gift that God gave to me. And I don't think that any of us can enjoy and inhabit the life God intends for us until we can enjoy and inhabit our masculinity. But I've made great progress in the last 10 years. Not by my own effort. It's come in the craziest way. The craziest way. Do you remember what I read to you before I read to you about John addressing children, fathers, and young men? The section right before that? Right before that, he says this. If you say that you walk in the light and you hate your brother, you're lying. If you love your brother, you walk in the light. If you hate your brother, you walk in the dark and you can't see because the darkness has blinded you. Where do we find our way to masculinity? Among the brothers. We come to masculinity together. Jesus made us a promise. When two or three of you are gathered in my name, I'll be there. He also made this extravagant claim, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. The masculine presence of Jesus inhabits the brotherhood. And when we get together and we bring our real selves, when it's not this towel-snapping, arm-punching, you know, bull-crapping stuff, when we don't have to make gay jokes to prove we're not gay, when we don't have to brag about how much money we're making, when we don't have to divert the conversation to the sports or weather, when we can bring our real selves into the room with real brothers and talk about where we really are, Jesus shows up. And here's what's happened. I've experienced it more times than I can count. I've come to rely on it. Here's what happens. I come to a meeting of the Samson Society. Samson Society, by the way, is a group of guys that I run with now. And it's all around the country. Heck, it's all around the world now. But it started right here at Christ Community Church. And I come, and there's a part of me, when I come to the meeting, there's a part of me that just wants to bring the persona, that wants to come larger than life. Don't bring the real Nate. You know, bring some bullshit, because that's safer. But really, the culture of the Samson Society, like the culture of a 12-step meeting, isn't friendly to that kind of falsity. I'll sit in a room and I'll talk honestly about where I am, about the success I've just experienced, if I've experienced a success, about a failure I've just experienced, if that's where I am. If I'll talk honestly about failure, if I'll be willing to share my weakness as my strength, if I'll show my real self, if I'll share my pain, and especially if I share my ignorance, I don't know what to do next. Here's what happens. From the mouths of my brothers, I hear the voice of the Father. And I'm affirmed. Nate Larkin, God made you a man. You're a man. You have what it takes to do this. You can do it. You haven't forfeited the grace of God. He doesn't reject any of His sons. You're still a son. You're a grown son. You're a man. You can do it. I get direction. I get encouragement. I get help. And I find myself, over the weeks and over the months and over the years, growing as a man. I don't think we can grow in manhood without growing together. And I think we got to break down the walls and make sure the young men can come in, because we need them. The young men need us. Otherwise, they're going to continue to take the question to the woman. They're going to squander the best years of their lives while we keep them on the sidelines and tell them that they're kids. No, we need to give them the gift of dignity. Let them know they're a man. Let them have responsibility. Let them make choices and take the consequences. Let's not treat them like children. Let's not regard them as children. I'm looking forward. I love Brandon's use of the word intergenerational. I think that's where this thing really breaks out. I look forward to being a part of an intergenerational brotherhood at Christ Community Church, where we welcome young men into manhood. I believe we can do it. I'm looking forward to be a part of it. All right, I don't know how long I talked. It seemed like a very long time. But I'll wrap it up there. What are we going to do now, John?
Party.
I think we're done. I think some of the guys are, you and your own, some of the guys are going to go get some dinner together.
Okay.
That's what I want to do, but that's it. That's
okay,
it.
Good.
Great job.
We're back. We hope you enjoyed Nate's talk at Christ Community Church. Hope that it's something that you might want to share with other people. Got a little bit of his story and a lot of talk about young men. We've got some good stuff coming up. Rob Brown is leading the 48 Hours of Frankness tour. So give us some of those dates for guys that have never gone on a 48 Hours weekend.
All right. Well, we have right now on the Samson Society site, we have six listed. But we have the first three coming up, March and April. March 25 through 27 is Atlanta, Georgia. Then coming up on April 8th through the 10th is Austin, Texas. Then we also got the guys down in Orlando, Florida, who will be throwing in the 48 Hours of Frankness on April 15th through the 17th. The other three cities we have lined up are Eugene, Oregon, Richmond, Virginia, and Denver, Colorado. Those dates are to be announced, and we have more cities being planned. But guys, make sure you look into this. This is a very powerful weekend in Atlanta, Georgia, on the 25th through the 27th of March, Austin, Texas in April, and Orlando, Florida in April. So go to the site to get more information and find out what can work for you.
All right, so basically anywhere in the country, this is accessible for you. It might take a little drive, but if you grab a guy with you, then it'll just be a road trip. Absolutely. We also want to remind you, shoot us a note at the samsonpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your thoughts on episodes. Last week we had Jay Asher talking about suicide and some pretty deep, heavy topics, and we want to hear what you're thinking, which topics are really resonating with you. We also just like to hear from you. If you have any questions or thoughts, samsonpodcast@gmail.com is the email address, so take a minute and drop us a line. And that is it for this week. So have a great week walking in community with each other.
Yes, sir.
And we will see you next week in episode 53. Take your day by day. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And that's the one step at a time. Give yourself time to heal. All of my people. To renew your trouble line. Everybody say, oh, 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 oh.
shame and living for real as long as you